These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Coming up in this episode...
And he's going to be that politician, metaphorically speaking, who calls and says, tell him Cornelius said hi.
I was amazed at, just for lack of a better word, how grimy the political scene is.
But I think this has been happening for a long time in a lot of places, not just Atlanta. So how is this sort of different?
I don't know if it is.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections. Hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB. I'm Orlando Montoya.
And I'm Peter Biello. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge. So, Orlando, we both live in Atlanta. How would you describe the affordability of the city?
It depends on where you live.
Depends on where you live.
I mean, I had a nice studio apartment just north of Midtown for $1,300 a month. I thought that was reasonable.
That does sound reasonable to me. I can see where you're coming from on that comment. There are parts of the city that are pretty affordable. There are parts that are very much not affordable, and the price per square foot is just insane. Not worth purchasing, in my view.
Yeah, but. don't try Buckhead. It's too much.
Don't try Buckhead. Even like parts of where you live, the neighborhood you live in, Old Fourth Ward, where I lived for a time too, can be pretty pricey.
Yeah, it just depends. Depends.
It depends. Yeah. How about Summer Hill? Do you know much about Summer Hill?
I don't know much about Summer Hill. I think there was a bakery. I went there once.
Summer Hill now. One of my favorite neighborhoods in Atlanta. Of course, I wasn't here decades ago what it used to be. Of course, that used to be where the Braves played. Now it's got...
So it's near Turner Field or Turner Field?
That's where I'm talking about. So like there's a nice strip, Georgia Avenue. It's just west of Grant Park. It's a cute neighborhood. And the reason I bring it up, because that's what this book is about today. It's about a little bit about gentrification, a little bit about being a gay black man. Those two things kind of intersecting in interesting ways.
It's about that neighborhood in particular?
That neighborhood and some others that were transformed ahead of the 1996 Olympics. That was a big time for Atlanta, where Atlanta wanted to become a world-class city. And so it started to really revitalize some of the housing in the city, in particular, housing where Olympic Village was going to be near Summer Hill.
Revitalize, i.e. gentrify.
Yes, basically. And there's a book that we're not talking about today. It's called Red Hot City by Dan Immergluck. It talks all about how this was an inflection point for Atlanta. Public housing was torn down but not replaced. Some of Atlanta's poorest residents were displaced. And part of that is happening here in this book. The book is called The Fantasies of Future Things, and it's by Doug Jones. This is Doug Jones's debut novel.
And I feel that this has been going on for a long time in Atlanta, though. So does this book focus mostly on the recent past?
It focuses on what was happening in the early 1990s as Atlanta was getting ready for the Olympics, in particular Summer Hill, where some row housing was being demolished to make way for prettier housing, we'll say, housing that would be suitable for television cameras when they all descended upon Atlanta to see the 1996 Summer Olympics.
So who are the main characters in this book?
The two main characters are Jacob and Daniel. They're both young, early 20s. Jacob just finished Morehouse, and he grew up in New York. Daniel is an Atlanta native, and they both work for this real estate company that's charged with redeveloping this part of Atlanta. That company is run by a white woman named Beth. Now, Beth is coming into this neighborhood kind of all sharp elbows, throwing her privilege around. This is a predominantly black neighborhood, and she's just kind of insensitively flexing her privilege, and these two young black men working for her are kind of torn between their paycheck and what they're charged with doing here, ostensibly revitalizing a neighborhood, but at what cost? So that's kind of what they're dealing with. Now, they each are going through their own type of struggle. Now, Jacob, he lives in a neighborhood called Little Five Points with a couple of roommates, Sean and Rodney. Now, for people who don't know Atlanta, do you know Little Five Points?
It's the weirdo capital of Atlanta, basically.
Yeah, it's got cool record stores.
Quirky and charming, let's just say that.
Quirky and charming, yeah. So he's sort of living his life there, and he's an out gay man. He goes to clubs, he hooks up, he is out to his friends. He doesn't really want to be defined professionally by being gay, but he's not ashamed of it, except that he has not told his parents. So coming out to his parents is a kind of one piece of inauthenticity that hangs over his head throughout the novel. So that's a source of tension.
So how does the real estate situation come into this?
Well, as I mentioned, they both work for that real estate company, and they are kind of feeling their way through this professional life where they don't know how much they believe in what's happening. They want to feel good about what's happening. Doug Jones, the author of this novel, first studied finance, and he did work with real estate professionals at some point in his career. So when I spoke with Doug Jones, he told me a little bit about what inspired his decision to weave this part into his novel.
I grew up in Bed-Stuy. You're familiar with Bed-Stuy?
Just in name only.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I would see investors and developers come through and take advantage of not even, quote-unquote, people who were less fortunate, people who weren't savvy, people who did not understand how the system worked, people didn't know how to answer questions, elderly folks whose family were not around, were missing, not checking on them. And being taken advantage of in that way. Sometimes there were policy, a lot of times there were policy decisions being affecting people, but those were on broader scales. What I saw at first was happening on a very micro level.
Well, like I said, I think this has been happening for a long time in a lot of places, not just Atlanta. So how is this sort of different?
I don't know if it is, in the sense that it could be anywhere. It's relatable in that way that the poor people always end up getting the short end of the stick. And sometimes people who come from those groups are drawn in to the conflict in ways that they didn't expect. And that, I think, is the case for Jacob and Daniel. There's an interesting aspect of this part of the novel, too, and that's there's Beth, as I mentioned, but also the opposition, which is Cornelius, the local politician, who is sort of there as well to sort of gain what he can politically from the situation.
And I suppose Cornelius is a black politician.
Cornelius is a black man who represents a black area of Atlanta, and he strikes me in this book as not someone who's necessarily invested in one particular outcome, so long as whatever outcome that happens, he can sell to his constituency as a victory.
Every good book has got to have a villain.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say he's a villain. He's just kind of part of the machinery that Doug Jones is trying to describe here. And this, too, is part of something or inspired by something he witnessed. It's not necessarily based on a real Atlanta politician, although it's completely believable that this could have happened. He based it on some of his experiences, again, I believe, in New York.
I was amazed at, just for lack of a better word, how grimy the political scene is.
Mm.
And I was in working in economic development. I was in a few meetings in which politicians, they held grudges, and for whatever reason, whatever the timing was, the time that they were able to exact their revenge happened at a time when I was around them. And I could actually see them, you know, taking the steps that they would, I'm going to do this person in.
Hmm.
And then when it happened, they would call the person's staff and be like, tell them that, you know, I'm dealing with assembly people and state senators. Tell them with assembly member so-and-so and so-and-so said hello. Tell them state representative said hello. And you're looking at this like, these people actually do this. Like, this is the way people actually navigate in the world. And they believe this to be okay. So that was remarkable for me. And I didn't want it to be, it felt when I was living through it, it felt a little bit cartoonish and detached, just because I couldn't believe that, you know, people actually conducted themselves in that way, but it was right there happening. And so I wanted to capture that happening, but I didn't want it to look, you know, so plastic and so formulaic, you know, in the book.
I think that's a fair way of describing how Cornelius comes off. It's like you said, he could be villainous, but you just see what his interests are in the moment, and you say, I see why he would think that.
And the actions they're talking about in that clip was pushing people out of their homes. So what is the action they're talking about?
He's referring to just the smarminess of politicians, okay. And Cornelius does have some level of that. I mean, like I said earlier, with Beth being sort of a hard to work with person who is sort of throwing her privilege around, Cornelius is having none of that, but he's not going to come at it as directly as Beth comes at things. He's going to come at it from the side, and he's going to be that politician, metaphorically speaking, who calls and says, tell him Cornelius said hi.
All right. So we've talked about the Cornelius and Beth and Jacob, the out black gay man. Who's the other character there? Daniel.
Daniel is the Atlanta native who's working alongside Jacob. And he is, if Jacob is dealing with being closeted from his parents, Daniel has his own parental issue. His mother has recently died. And so in the chapters where we're focusing on Daniel, he's cleaning out his mother's house with the help of his half-siblings. Now, Daniel is had a black father who's not in the picture, and a white mother and a white stepfather and two white siblings. So he's different from his siblings, and he's kind of, as he's cleaning out his mother's house, learning about his past and about his mother's life. His mother always seemed like a very angry person, very tired. Why was she that way? What was happening in his life that led him to this point? He's not, to the extent that Jacob is, struggling with his sexual identity. But he's struggling with his past and with his mother. And there's one scene that I just thought was so powerful in this book. And there are a lot of them. A different reader may have picked up on a different one, but I picked up on the one where. So Daniel and his siblings go to the same school. And a black teacher finally puts it together that Daniel and his siblings are actually siblings. And she says something to the effect of, oh, it all makes sense now. Now, you can take that comment in a variety of ways. That comment gets back to Daniel's mother, whose name is Sue Ellen. And Sue Ellen just flips out. Like, this is just an offense that she can no longer stand, right? And so she goes into the school, and she demands an apology from this black teacher. So a white woman going into a school, demanding an apology from a black teacher. And the principal is kind of like, well, you better apologize because she could really make trouble. So you see the scene where she's questioning this teacher. And it's just, you cringe because it's so sad, but then you realize that she's in so much pain that this is where she feels like she can get out her aggression.
My editor, Yadon Israel, at Simon & Schuster, he and I were talking, and there was a very small interaction between Daniel's mom, Sue Ellen, and the teacher. It was a very quick and very minor. And Yadon asked me the question. He was like, hey, you know, the world is coming for this woman. Everything is coming for this woman. And the last thing that happens all of a sudden is this teacher who asks her this question. And she has been battling all along to put her kids on equal footing. And this teacher comes up and says this. And at the time, what amounted to was a slap on the wrist was her reaction. He was like, I don't think that would happen like that. And I don't think that she would just let that slide. And from a character development standpoint, it really took her from being this character that everyone, you know, when you read it, and you know, I just wanted everyone like, oh, what was she and everything else, to, you know, poor her, poor Sue Ellen. To what I hope emerges is a really sophisticated character with a background that says, huh, what kind of human being is she?
And so when you learn more about what Daniel's mother, Sue Ellen, had to do to keep their family whole, to keep them solvent, you learn a little bit more about why someone may have had such an emotionally raw and irrational response to such a small, minor comment.
Yeah, it sounds like we're learning a lot about the whole family here. It's like almost a family drama.
Yeah, it's a credit to the author that you kind of learn slowly how these people became who they are. And you can see them struggle with the questions that will define who they are going forward. I think that's the mark of a really good literary novel. I'm just kind of getting ahead of myself here on what gives it the narrative edge, but I will say that much, yeah.
So speaking of someone who has to decide, you know, what questions he's going to talk about in his life, getting back to Jacob, does he come out in the book?
Should I reveal that? I don't know. I mean, that's the thing at the end. Okay, I will say that yes, he does. I don't think it's that much of a spoiler. I think the big what's going to happen is how his parents respond, which I will not say.
Yeah.
And the other question kind of hovering over this, you know, Jacob-Daniel alternation is, are they going to get together? I won't share that either. There is another character named Sherman who becomes a kind of savior complex person for Jacob, and also helps him steer his professional moral compass in the right direction too, in a really nice way. I thought that was interesting. And there are several points in this book where the author explicitly points out how difficult it is to be a gay black man, because it's difficult to sort of open up and share your feelings in that way. And like, and I do not know what it's like to be a gay man. I do not know what it's like to be a black man, but I know just as a man that it's difficult to be vulnerable with other men at times. So I did ask him about what it is like to try to be vulnerable or feel like you really want to be vulnerable as a black man, as a gay man. And how is it different? What are the extra stresses that come with those layers of identity? And he had an interesting perspective on that.
I remember once I was having just a really difficult time emotionally with a girlfriend, and you know, I went and I complained to my father. He was like looking at me like, that's not what we do. You know, and it really took me out of the moment. And I think particularly during the 70s and the 80s and probably times prior to, black men are raised, unfortunately, to be detached from their feelings. You know, the quote unquote big black monster, you know, but at least to be unfeeling and desensitized to any sort of softness, any sort of vulnerability. It also becomes a comment about how femininity is pictured, because if these things are masculine, then what becomes feminine? And if you value what is masculine in this way, do you devalue what is feminine? You know, so asking all those sorts of questions.
So let me ask you, what do you make of his comment there?
I would like to know if the book had a lot of scene setting, you know, as into the gay community of that time. You know, was there descriptions of various places that people went, like bars and stuff?
You know, I learned rather little about 90s gay culture in Atlanta. There are names that are mentioned, clubs that I think may have existed in Little Five Points back in the day, but maybe don't anymore. Trax was named as one. Is Trax a familiar name to you?
These are probably just made up.
Yeah, I don't know. You weren't here in the 90s, right?
No.
So, I mean, so who knows? But the scene setting, no, didn't have to do with gay culture necessarily. You know, Jacob opens the book describing it as, you know, a black Disneyland, a place where, you know, the rules that applied to black people everywhere else didn't seem to apply in Atlanta.
You know, I think Atlanta has always been a gay mecca, and that's going to be the subject of the book that we talk about next week. So this is quite interesting to hear about this section of the book. What gives this book the narrative edge in terms of, we got real estate, we've got gentrification, we've got black gay men, we've got all kinds of things, but writerly things, what gives this book the narrative edge?
I think it captures the messiness of your 20s really well, regardless of whether you're gay or straight or whatever. There's a lot happening in your 20s all at once. You're trying to figure out relationships. You're trying to figure out your profession. You're trying to find a purpose in life, because your trajectory at that point in your life is long. So you got to choose wisely. So both of these characters, to some extent, you feel their anxiety without Doug Jones ever having to point it out necessarily. And I think that's great. There are a variety of things that he's managing well. I think the interpersonal relationships always make or break a literary novel like this. A literary novel, in my view, is always about relationships between people. So what relationships are being cultivated here? The one between Jacob and Daniel is somewhat standoffish for most of this book. They interact, but there's always a wall. The relationship between Jacob and Sherman, that guy with the savior complex I mentioned, is fascinating and worth following. I think there's a lot to that. And I think the relationship between both these men and the city of Atlanta itself, I think, is a really nice one, because you kind of get a sense of what is the relationship between anyone in their community. How do they want to define how they treat their community? And they're, of course, doing it through their work. So how can they orient their professional lives to be of positive service to their community? And of course, the relationship between Jacob and his parents, it's not a huge presence in this book. They exist mostly as figures on a phone in the distance, but it's still important to Jacob, and you can tell. And I think that raises the stakes for him. And for me as a reader, I wanted to know how it turned out.
Well, I think we got to get back to Summer Hill and the Olympics too at some point, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, development happens. That's kind of part of the arc of the book, right? In the beginning of the book, you see a protest and a disturbance surrounding a press conference about all these buildings that are going to be knocked down and buildings that are going to go up. Stuff happens by the end of the book. I can't spoil it.
Oh, okay.
I can't spoil it. But obviously we know, right? We're you know, 30 years in the future. Uh-huh. We saw how Atlanta has changed since the Olympics.
Well, there's going to be a new gentrification book today.
About the Beltline, perhaps?
About the Beltline. And then there could be a gentrification book from the 1970s. You know,
yeah.
It was happening when my neighborhood, the Old Fourth Ward, was cleared out.
Right, right.
So, anyways, fascinating. The book is called The Fantasies of Future Things by Doug Jones. Peter, thanks for telling me about it.
Glad to.
When a massive chemical fire erupted at the biolab facility in Conyers, thick smoke filled the air, forcing evacuations. But for many, it wasn't the first time, and it wouldn't be the last. I'm Pamela Kirkland. In GPB's new podcast, Manufacturing Danger, The Biolab Story, I investigate what caused the fire, the response, and what it means for Conyers residents today. Listen at gpb.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts.